From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The opioid crisis in the United States continues to claim lives as pharmaceutical executives face public scrutiny about what they knew about the addictive nature of a certain class of prescription painkillers. Now, a new book examines a bottom-up approach to tackling addiction that has great relevance for the opioid epidemic in the U.S. Award-winning journalist Travis Lupik explores the history of a community in Vancouver, British Columbia, where grassroots activists worked to create a safe space for themselves that transformed how they managed their addiction. Travis Lupik is based in Vancouver's downtown East Side. He has more than a decade's experience working as a staff reporter and editor for the Georgia Strait newspaper. He received an award from the Canadian Association of Journalists for his coverage of Canada's fentanyl crisis. And he now joins me to discuss his new book called Fighting for Space, How a Group of Drug Users Transformed One City's Struggle with Addiction. Welcome to the program, Travis.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, Vancouver in Canada, British Columbia, is a city that, you know, is a tourist destination. People who haven't heard about this issue of how the downtown East Side has this rich history may not know anything about this revolutionary approach to dealing with addiction. How far back does the history of the Vancouver downtown East Side and its transformation by this group of drug users, how far back does it go, and how involved is it with the HIV crisis?
The book begins in 1990-91, when a drug crisis similar to the drug crisis that North America struggles with today was just getting off the ground in Vancouver. In 1991, overdose deaths were steadily ticking up in Vancouver, especially in that marginalized neighborhood you mentioned, the downtown East Side. And the HIV crisis was arriving at the same time. There was also an outbreak of hepatitis C. So in this really, really small, traditionally low-income neighborhood called the downtown East Side, you had all these health problems swirling, and government was nowhere to be found. There wasn't a single clinic in this 20-square block neighborhood. And a health emergency was coming up on it pretty fast.
So the characters whose story you tell in your book, these are individuals who went on then to take this issue by themselves. They took it on upon themselves to, first of all, I understand that their main goal was something that doctors think about, harm reduction, which is if you care about people who struggle with addiction, then you want to prevent them from dying, right? So did that sort of framework underpin how they started their work?
Exactly. At the same time that these health problems arrived in the downtown East Side, this really amazing group of activists slowly got together. Women like Liz Evans, who went on to found the Portland Hotel Society, and Anne Livingston, who co-founded the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. These sort of really grassroots organizations began to work with each other in the downtown East Side, really taking care of the community themselves because the government was not. And while they weren't calling it harm reduction just yet in the early 1990s, harm reduction is what they were doing. That is, simply trying to limit the harmful effects of drug abuse, drug use, and addiction. So doing things like early needle exchange, giving people clean needles so that they didn't have to use dirty needles when they were injecting drugs. Really simple things like helping drug users gain access to clean water so that they didn't have to inject with the puddle water they found in an alley. And later on in the book, in the late 90s, early 2000s, they began to talk about things like supervised injection sites.
So instead of moralizing, passing judgment, saying that people simply don't have enough willpower, there should be zero tolerance for drug use, instead of saying all of that or using that approach, which is a standard traditional approach here in the United States based on drug prohibition, this group of people simply said, let's give addicts a safe space to simply be. And at least they won't die from preventable things, right?
That's exactly what it is. It's a great phrase you just used, a safe space, because before we were calling these sorts of programs harm reduction, People like Liz Evans, Anne Livingston, their goal was really simple, to give people space. I mean, that's it. They just wanted a place where drug users could deal with their addictions without fear of persecution by police. Again, you know, without being forced to inject with puddle water in an alley, looking over their shoulder and injecting drugs in a rushed and dangerous way. All they wanted was a place to exist where drug users were not persecuted. Mm-hmm. You know, inherent in harm reduction is this understanding that it's not necessarily the drugs that do the most damage to a person, but it's actually the laws of prohibition, persecution by police, that can do the most damage to a drug user. Mm-hmm. For example, cocaine does not cause a hepatitis C infection, but injecting cocaine with a dirty needle can cause a hepatitis C infection. So it's actually laws that forbid needle exchange that can facilitate the spread of disease. Harm reduction seeks to reduce those sorts of harms.
And also, of course, how important was the realization that drug addiction is a social problem? It's one that is exacerbated when societal issues like poverty, like racism, cause trauma in individuals.
Yeah, in the downtown East Side, it's barely an overstatement to say that almost every single drug user in that community is struggling with some sort of trauma. Mm. There is a disproportionate number of indigenous people living in the neighborhood and still struggling with the effects of colonialism and that sort of thing.
First Nations communities, as Canadians refer to it, yeah.
Yes, Native Americans, indigenous people in Canada. There's many women in the downtown East Side who have struggled with abuse. And they've sort of collected in this neighborhood because this neighborhood takes care of its members. People who might not feel accepted somewhere else feel welcome in the downtown East Side. But they're still marginalized and they're still dealing with trauma. So I think when we're talking about addiction in this group of people, we need to recognize that these people are self-medicating. So if you're going to persecute them, if you're going to imprison them, you're victimizing a victim.
So let's go a little bit into some of the science that we know that you also write about in your book. There was a scientist named Bruce Alexander who's done work on trying to understand how addiction works that really clarifies that this approach that Vancouver's downtown East Side's activists used is really the superior approach to the traditional one. Tell us about the studies that Alexander did that confirm that we need to rethink our way, rethink addiction.
Yeah, Bruce Alexander was a scientist working in Vancouver, working in the downtown East Side in the 1970s. And in the 1970s, an accepted theory of addiction said that it was the drugs that caused addiction. If you do drugs, you'll become addicted. And there was some evidence for this. If you kept a mouse or a rat in isolation and gave it narcotics like cocaine or opiates like heroin, the rat would use the drugs and become addicted. But Bruce Alexander began to sort of not even challenge, but poke at that question, saying, is it really the drugs or maybe is it the conditions that the rat is living in that's making him use the drugs? The experiment that he developed, later dubbed Rat Park, was to sort of change the environment of the rats and then observe whether or not their drug use changed. So instead of keeping rats in isolation, he created this really nice sort of open, free-range facility where there was a forest painted on the walls and lots of wood chips and fluff for the rats to play with, to hibernate, to sort of live in a cozy environment. And then the same rats were given a choice of water or a morphine solution. And what Dr. Bruce Alexander found is when the rats' environment changed, when they were given a nicer place to live, when they were not subjected to isolation, even given the choice of morphine and water, they used significantly less drugs. And it really, not at first, but over the next couple of decades, began to change how a lot of academics and then eventually the general public look at addiction.
Hmm. Whereas the more traditional studies looked at rats in this isolated box where they were basically given nothing but the addictive substance that they would then end up becoming addicted to. And scientists weren't thinking about the fact that the rats might have been using or choosing those drugs because they essentially had these terrible environments they were living in. So environmental factors play a big role. Let's let's talk a little bit about how one scientist who might be a little bit well known here in the United States helped to talk about these issues in this new way. Dr. Gabor Mate, whose work in Vancouver at the Portland Hotel has really been very, very powerful in how he talks about rethinking addiction. What has Gabor Mate contributed to this conversation?
Gabor Mate's focus has been childhood trauma. He took care of tenants at the Portland Hotel in Vancouver through the 1990s. And he found that a huge number of them, plus 90%, had been victims of childhood trauma, whether sexual abuse, whether physical abuse, or whether some sort of extreme neglect. And so instead of seeing his tenants, his patients, as drug users who were trying to have a good time or were just a little lazy, he saw his patients as victims, and he saw their drug use as a coping mechanism. As a normal response, actually, to an abnormal situation. And this tells us that these people are victims. And so if you see drug users, people addicted to drugs, as victims, Dr. Gabor Mate writes in his book, Hungry Ghosts, you no longer want to victimize them with persecution, with arrest, with prison time. You don't want to say that drugs are okay, but you begin to realize that a carrot will work significantly better than a stick in treating addiction. And how this relates to Bruce Alexander's work that we were talking about a minute ago is to say maybe there's something that we can do with these people's environments, with these people's social conditions. If they're not just using drugs because drugs are addictive, if they're using drugs because they're a victim of childhood trauma, perhaps that should change how we respond to their addiction. Mm.
So let's dig a little bit deeper into the work that the Portland Hotel Society did and VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. We started the story of some of these individuals who formed this group. Were the people whose names you mentioned, were they themselves struggling with addiction, or what motivated them to do this work?
So the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, the best way to think about it is a drug user union, essentially. Mm. So its founding members, Ann Livingston and Bud Osborne, got together. They couldn't even meet indoors because at the time, drug users were not even allowed inside. That was the level of stigmatization and marginalization that was going on. So they began to meet in parks in the downtown east side and say, what do we want? We want a say in drug policy. We want things like clean needles so that we're not at risk of hepatitis C. The same time that the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, VANDU, was organizing, Liz Evans was beginning to take people in off the streets and put people into the rooms at the Portland Hotel. And as I tell this story, listeners can think about what we were just saying about Bruce Alexander's work in Rat Park and draw similarities. Liz Evans was taking tenants in off the street and saying, you live here now, and you're always going to live here now. You no longer need to fear eviction for a mental health outburst. You no longer need to fear eviction for drug use. You no longer need to fear that I'm going to call the police if you struggle with an overdose. This is your home now. And it had this really interesting unintended consequence. Liz Evans was just trying to be kind, but there was this really neat thing. When she told people they did not need to fear eviction for drug use or a mental health outburst, the unintended consequence was those same people actually used fewer drugs and had fewer mental health outbursts. She'd improved their environment and removed the stress, removed fear of addiction, and found that the mental health challenges or the addiction that they were struggling with actually improved.
She, in effect, did Bruce Alexander's experiment on human subjects, inadvertently, perhaps. But so then what exactly was the government's response to all of this? Because, of course, we are dealing with these traditional means of looking at addiction. There's often not enough support from governments or active opposition. How did VANDU, the Portland Hotel Society, and these groups in Vancouver convince local authorities that what they were doing was actually much more effective than the standard prohibition and police response, criminalization of drug use?
Well, it was not easy. Today in 2018, Vancouver is sort of celebrated for harm reduction and celebrated as the first and for 15 years, the only city in North America to have a supervised injection site. And the government takes a lot of credit for that today. The government was not on board with a supervised injection site or even needle exchange at first. Harm reduction in Vancouver is the result of more than a decade of hard work performed by activists, the Portland Hotel Society and the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, among other groups. They marched in the streets demanding a say in drug policy. You know, drug users saying, "We want a say in the healthcare programs that you're designing for us." They occupied City Hall. They interrupted city council meetings. They lobbied the mayor. They brought in experts from Europe who had gotten harm reduction and injection sites off the ground in Europe a decade or so earlier. They brought these people over to Vancouver and involved them in education campaigns. They worked with journalists. It was actually a very conscious education campaign alongside street protests, bringing larger numbers of allies and then eventually politicians on board to change how Vancouver responds with addiction.
So today, how are these organizations doing? Canada has its own opioid epidemic, like the United States is struggling with. Has VANDU and the Portland Hotel Society changed anything about what they do, or are they applying the same approach to cocaine users that they used for, with cocaine users and other drug users, to the sort of modern class of drugs that's now plaguing societies?
Yeah, so America is struggling with an epidemic of overdose deaths, 64,000 in 2016, up from 15,000 just 20 years earlier. Vancouver is struggling with the same problem. For many years, Vancouver's approach with harm reduction was very successful. During our overdose crisis of the 1990s, there was a peak of 400 overdose deaths across British Columbia in 1998. Just a few years later, by 2003, that was reduced by 50% to an average of 204 deaths, overdose deaths annually. And that 50% reduction was actually maintained for an entire decade. Right through to 2010, there was an average of 204 overdose deaths a year. So, you know, people who have studied health outcomes know that a 50% reduction that's maintained for a decade is a big deal. Harm reduction in Vancouver worked. But then fentanyl arrived. A synthetic opiate significantly stronger than heroin. And fentanyl changed everything in Vancouver. So 1998, Vancouver's first overdose crisis, a peak of 400 overdose deaths. In 2017 in BC, there was more than 1,400.
Wow. And so fentanyl is this drug that literally can kill a person with just a few grains of the substance.
A very dangerous substance, and the same substance that is driving an increasing number of deaths, an increasing portion of America's opiate epidemic. So harm reduction worked, but then fentanyl arrived, and fentanyl is a really tricky problem. Again, just like it was in the 90s, government was slow to react in Vancouver, and the downtown east side had to take care of itself. And it was actually some of the very same activists, people like Anne Livingston, the co-founder of VANDU, who said, again, I'm walking alleys and I'm responding to overdoses and government is nowhere to be seen. And just like she did in the 90s, establishing unsanctioned injection sites, trying to shame the government into action. And Livingston again set up an unsanctioned injection site in the winter of 2016, started bringing people in from the alley saying, use drugs here, you know, where me and my staff can respond if one of you overdose. Or we can administer naloxone, I think it's called Narcan in the United States, or we can revive you if you need help.
This is the sort of, I don't know, antidote is one way of looking at it to fentanyl and other opioids. Yeah.
And the government actually didn't, again, it was slow. Again, it was activists making a concerted effort. But in December 2016, the provincial government in British Columbia looked at Anne Livingston and her partner, Sarah Blythe. The government looked at their unsanctioned injection site and said, they said, instead of shutting this thing down, we're going to emulate it. And within the next few weeks, they'd actually opened 15 of these injection sites. They're actually officially called overdose prevention sites in British Columbia now. They opened 15 of these overdose prevention sites across the province and expanded harm reduction measures far beyond Vancouver, really for the first time that they had been expanded in more than a decade.
So the work that Vandu and Portland Hotel Society had done since the 90s, in a way, prepared the city for tackling this even more dangerous crisis of addiction, laid the groundwork for it.
Exactly. I don't think the government would have responded so positively to Anne Livingston's unsanctioned injection site in 2017 if there hadn't been that two decades of activists' work in Vancouver that was in response to our overdose crisis in the 90s. And with what I'm trying to say with the book, with Fighting for Space, is instead of taking two decades to have that conversation like Vancouver did, cities like Philadelphia, Boston, they should look to Vancouver, look to our overdose crisis in the 90s that I recount in the book, and learn from our mistakes and really try and save all of us some time here and save some lives.
Right. Saving lives, that again, coming back to what we talked about, if you care about the people that are dying from this crisis, saving lives should be the first and foremost goal rather than the moralizing, the criminalizing. So there are these cities in the United States that have looked at what Vancouver's been doing for decades. You know, this is our neighbor to the north, and you know, we share a lot culturally, these two countries. Are there cities in the U.S. that have already begun experimenting with the model that Vancouver offers?
It's happening. Just a couple weeks ago, Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York City publicly came out in favor of opening four supervised injection sites across New York on a trial basis. I think they're going to run for 3 years, hopefully opening as soon as this summer. So New York might be the first. San Francisco is talking about injection sites. Philadelphia, Seattle. These conversations are happening across America right now. Sadly, it took an overdose epidemic for many jurisdictions to get to the point where they're even ready to talk about this stuff. And I know that these ideas are still really controversial. But they were really controversial in Vancouver, too. There was pushback through the 90s and early 2000s. So looking to the Vancouver example, what happened to that opposition? It's really interesting to note that the same business owners, community groups that were actually against supervised injection sites before they opened in Vancouver, very quickly, within just a couple of years, really came on board. They saw that instead of using drugs in business owners' doorways, people were using drugs inside injection sites. Instead of leaving discarded needles on the sidewalks, people were depositing them inside supervised injection sites. I really encourage jurisdictions across North America that are having the supervised injection debate, the harm reduction debate, to look to Vancouver's story.
And of course, a lot of our you know, wrong-headed approach to addiction has been rooted in racism. In the United States, we've seen communities of color as being the primary victims of drug addiction, and so we've criminalized people, put an entire generation of people behind bars. Today, we're seeing a largely white struggle with addiction. It's causing people to rethink or at least have some more compassion. You know, those in power seem to want to have more compassion for the white victims of addiction. And at the very least, this approach that you point out in your book might be one that people are more receptive to. That is not to say, of course, that the opioid crisis only affects white Americans. There are now communities of color also succumbing. Rates of addiction among African Americans have skyrocketed with opioid use as well. So if you were to, say, talk to Jeff Sessions about dealing with the U.S.'s huge crisis, or even President Trump or somebody in the Trump administration, how would you answer the question of we need to do something about addiction? Because here in the United States, people are still looking at this as take away the addiction, take away the source of addiction, take away the drugs, take away the access to the opioids, and that's how you transform the problem. But that isn't the problem. That isn't the approach that Vancouver has shown works, right?
Yeah, I think I would tell Jeff Sessions or anybody working in drug policy at the federal level in the United States that after 100 years of the war on drugs, it's simply time to try something else. Drug use has not declined or barely declined. People will always use drugs. They have since Roman times and before. And right now, people across North America are dying at such a rate that we, you know, it's such a radical problem that we need a radical turn in how we respond to it. 64,000 deaths in 2016. We need to transform how we respond to addiction. And I think harm reduction can be an important first step. It's not the last step. You know, harm reduction does not directly move people into treatment. It meets people where they're at and says, let me alleviate the harms that you're dealing with. What harm reduction does, though, is keep people alive long enough to get to a place where they're ready for treatment. That's, I think, the message that we need to broadcast here on harm reduction in the context of the opiate epidemic.
Right, because these opioids are so potent, they cause overdose deaths so easily, and yet they are preventable. So rather than trying to address this as let's end drug use, if we address this from the perspective of let's keep drug users alive, the ending drug use becomes more possible, right?
Yeah, these are preventable deaths, like you just said. Yeah. British Columbia now has more than 15 overdose prevention sites, injection sites, operating across the province. Since they opened in December 2016, they've seen more than 200,000 visits. They've reversed hundreds of overdoses and not one single death. Insight has operated since 2003, hundreds of thousands of visits, thousands of overdose reversals, never one overdose death. Every overdose death is preventable. If we get people using drugs out in the open, out of the shadows, in an environment where there is someone to respond in the event of an overdose, all of these lives can be saved.
Unfortunately, the personal responsibility framework of conservative ideology often stands in the way of the approach rooted in let's examine environmental factors and so on. Politics do get in the way, but perhaps your book will go a ways towards addressing that. Travis, I know you're going to be on book tour with your book, even in several American U.S. cities. Can you give us a website where people can find out where they could come and see you?
Yeah, we're doing the U.S. Northeast. We start in Boston on June 15th, then down through New York, Washington, etc. Fightingforspace.com.
Fightingforspace.com. You can click on events to find where Travis Lupik will be speaking in the coming months about his book. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Travis Lupik has been my guest. He's an award-winning journalist based in Vancouver's downtown east side. He has more than a decade's experience working as a staff reporter and editor for the Georgia Strait newspaper. He received an award from the Canadian Association of Journalists for his coverage of Canada's fentanyl crisis. And we've been discussing his new book, Fighting for Space, How a Group of Drug Users Transformed One City's Struggle with Addiction. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.